Good evening. I'm Glenn Lowry, the director of the Museum of Modern Art, and I'm thrilled that Jacques Herzog, one of the partners in Herzog & de Meuron, is here with us tonight for a conversation. This is the first of a series of conversations with artists and architects that will take place over the course of the fall and then the winter and spring, and for us a unique opportunity to really get a sense of how an artist thinks and approaches his or her work. And what we'll do is have a conversation for roughly 45 minutes, an hour, and then turn the conversation over to all of you so that you can have a chance to ask Jacques whatever questions may be on your mind. The reason Jacques and I are talking tonight is really very simple, that after the Museum of Modern Art opened in early 2000, or late 2004, we decided to invite an architect to do an artist choice, a project and program that had traditionally been run at the museum really as an opportunity for sculptors and painters to rummage in our collection and look at what they found most interesting and then essentially act as their own curator. But we thought, given the fact that we had devoted several years to building, it made an awful lot of sense to talk to an architect and see what an architect would do with our collection. And of course, Jacques and Pierre were no strangers to us. Not only have they been long-standing friends of our institution, but also of the Department of Architecture and Design, well represented in many exhibitions. But Jacques and Pierre had also participated in the charrette that led to the construction of this building, so that we had really a long-standing affiliation and relationship with both Jacques and Pierre. The result is Perception Restrained, an exhibition that is on the third floor and will be on view until September 25th. So if you haven't had an opportunity to see it, I hope you will, and perhaps this evening's conversation will encourage you, if you've already seen it, to take a second look. Jacques hardly needs an introduction, and certainly not one to a New York audience, but I think it is worth saying a few things about both Jacques and Pierre and their practice, a practice that I've come to know both at a professional level but also at a personal level. And my admiration for what Jacques and Pierre do is enormous. They have built now on almost every continent but Africa, as far as I can tell, and I'm sure before long they will have conquered those continents that they're not yet on. But more importantly, they have, over the last 20-plus years, developed a practice that is consistently original, innovative, daring, and bold. They have made somewhat of a specialty in designing museums. And as I was walking in tonight, I was just quickly trying to think of all of their museum-based projects, and I'm sure I will have missed one or two. But, of course, they made a mark with the beautiful pavilion that they designed in Munich for Ginny Goetz. Call it a private museum, a personal museum, and perhaps we'll talk about the difference between the private and the public over the course of the evening. They designed the Tate Modern and now are in the process of designing a new addition, actually really a new building, it's hardly an addition, to that project. The Walker Art Center, the de Young Museum, part of the San Francisco Art Museums, they were just announced as the architects for the Miami Art Museum project that has a direct link with the Museum of Modern Art, because Terry Riley, who is a close friend of Jacques and for many years the chief curator of architecture and design, is now the director of the Miami Art Museum. The Parish Art Museum, close by. And what I still think of as my favorite museum, the absolutely remarkable Schaulager in Basel, an institution that is unique and that I think really merges these two different strands in their practice between the private and the public. So Tonight, we want to focus on Jacques' role not simply as an architect, but also as a curator, as someone who can not only work with objects directly, but perhaps then, in ways that many curators never do, create the environment in which they're seen as well as in which they're selected. And so, Jacques, welcome. That was a very long-winded introduction and a long-winded way of saying how grateful we are that you're here with us tonight. Let me begin by just getting your impressions, Jacques, of what it was like to switch gears from an architect to a curator.
Well, first of all, Glenn, I would like to thank you for the opportunity to, first of all, do this, and secondly, to talk to you here tonight. In fact, I think it's good if we open later to the floor, because I think the good thing about these conversations is that it's really a conversation between different people, so we can really explain things and look at things from different angles and not just from my own perspective, because whatever I say, it's probably something I have written about before, especially in the case of the installation here. So there's a danger to repeat myself. I was really very excited when you invited us to do this installation here, because it was the first time you asked for an architect to do this. It was a great honor, and also somewhat we didn't know what to do, because many things have been done, and we don't see us as curators. We don't see ourselves as curators nor as artists. But on the other hand, of course, we are not naive. We have been thinking about museums, about installations, about art. We have been collaborating with artists since many, many years. And we love art. So we have a lot of ingredients on the table that make it at least a possibility to do this. We then had quite a few ideas in our mind how such a space, because it's basically not a show, it's basically one room, and to think of one room being different in a big museum. And this idea, in fact, of one room, or then maybe a group of rooms being totally different from the rest, was leading to the idea of what we later called anchor rooms. And this idea, as a conceptual idea, was extremely important. So this show here is at the beginning of quite a few things that have become important in some of the projects here that you were mentioning, be it the parish, also the Tate project, and another museum you haven't mentioned, whether it's the Espacio Goya in Zaragoza, a new museum which is dedicated to the work of Goya, where we took this idea of this special room, this room of this anchor space to a different level. But here, we wanted to do something which is different in that the whole space is really like an installation. And I don't want to explain that in too many details, because you can see it up there. What always, in recent time, really excited us, but also somehow frustrated us, was that we saw rooms, namely on our trips to China, when you see temples, which in fact are also galleries, also spaces where architecture, art, smell, fabric, the way things are arranged, have a kind of a permanence. And it's sculpture, it's art, but it's also architecture. And you cannot separate the things. And, of course, artists have done installation pieces, but mostly inside museums. Also in the Schaulager, by the way. The Schaulager, probably with the Rat King, and also the piece by Bob Gober, is certainly was very influential for us on the way to do this. And we were fascinated by the idea of doing something where architecture is really together with the artwork or with the artwork, something that you cannot separate, as opposed to the loft idea of a gallery. I mean, that was how we approached the whole thing.
In the wall text that you wrote, you talk about one of your goals for the installation as being to put pressure on visitors' perception, intensifying it, enduring it, and making it more individual. What was behind that sense of pressure, and to what degree do you think the space compels one to react differently than a more traditional environment?
Of course, somehow you could say it is stupid to put great artworks in a cupboard. And it is also stupid if we would do it more than once. But I think for this short amount of time, to do this leads to different understanding and a different way to see or to even remember this or that artwork, also in the way the context is playing. That's why I think the perception is, of course, restrained, and it needs a different effort or a stronger effort from everybody to see what is there and to see it from a different angle, to make it different. And, of course, different is not always better. And I don't say this is better, but the whole thing together, I think, is an interesting way for a short amount of time to encounter these artworks differently. Because very often in your museum, the new buildings are here, the new galleries are here, everything is so grand. I mean, everything is so great, and the light works well, and everything is, I mean, you can't improve. I mean, what should I do? You know, I cannot put up a painting a little bit differently. Otherwise, I would be, you know, like wiser than a curator, you know, and put this Wichtel together with this kind of Picasso, and this is not our role. So we had to tackle the thing from another side. And in fact, I think it's quite interesting to see things in a totally unexpected context. I think this really works for a certain amount of time.
I think there's also a dimension of desiring that which you can't have. And by restraining viewers' ability to look, it actually makes you even more curious. You want to know what it is that you're not seeing.
Absolutely. This moment is inherent in this whole installation. And, of course, this is an artistic strategy that we have learned from people like Naumann or Matthew Barney and others who have used that in their own work.
You decided to use a wall text, a very traditional kind of curatorial strategy. Was that intentional? Were you looking to replicate the traditional means by which most exhibitions are structured?
Yeah, I didn't see anything more adequate. It also should look like a normal exhibition. It shouldn't look like you kind of enter, something which is not in the logic of the institution. I think it makes it more, normal, and the surprise is even bigger, as opposed to when we would announce it in a totally different way.
I think one of the most interesting aspects of the installation is that while the traditional objects, painting, sculpture, drawings, architecture, design, are restrained. They are hidden from view. The less traditional art forms that are often integral to our institution, film and media, actually bombard you. They become the ceiling of the gallery. What were you trying to achieve there? And what were you thinking about? How did you come up with this idea of this animated ceiling?
We wanted to reverse, in many ways, what MoMA represents in the mind of people. I don't say what it represents really, because whatever we show in the exhibition is part of MoMA's collections, of which we all know it's the greatest collections in the world. So it was more interesting to show things from a different angle, as I said before, in a different spatial condition with different perceptual issues and different aspects of the work. We wanted to show everything that normally is not seen, which is not so easy to understand on the purely formal logic, but on the more psychological and emotional logic, which is more revealing other moments of our society, of our human culture, sexual issues, emotional issues, brutality, all those things which in fact fill the newspapers and are part of our daily lives. But as soon as you go to a museum, all of a sudden things should be different and our perception would be steered to you know, more issues of beauty and harmony and proportion, which is also great, you know. But here we wanted to reverse it, and we wanted to point out, and we used only fragments of those movies or videos which are using that kind of moment of emotional shock. And it was great, by the way, that all the directors were quite happy and excited to give us the right to do it, because not only wouldn't we project everything horizontally, not only was it not in a cinema, but it was only fragments, and it was in the ceiling, and it was just on small screens. So they all went, made a long way, and that made us really, you know, think that it's kind of interesting also for these guys to be seen or in a different way, especially because it's only an installation, and it's not an artwork that would be reproduced.
A number of reviewers of the exhibition read this installation as either an explicit or an implied critique of the Museum of Modern Art and its traditions. Was that intentional? Was that a misread on their part?
I think that's a total misread. We were in that competition, and some reviewers said that by frustration or something like that, we would have done something as like a revenge or so. And whoever knows Pierre Mie knows that not a second would we have had such an idea. It's ridiculous. I'm actually happy not to have been the architect. It's a critique. Of course, you can always critique a museum, but what is it good for? I mean, why should we do that? It's where you have the greatest collections. What should I say? You know, we put the things in different cupboards, so you could say it's a reproduction of the departmental structure of the museum, and we all can question this and could critique it. And maybe that, you know, in this whole way we show it, is there is an inherent reflection of what the museum is, but the museum is always also in a process of transformation. And I remember when we did the charrette, that was one of the things that was mentioned, and is maybe now less the case, that in the future you wanted to have more parallel presentations of photography together with painting and sculpture and even architecture, that the things would not be split or not be segregated in the same way. And maybe this is now less being realized than you intended it to do. But critique per se, I don't think that art, which is critical or political in that direct, explicit way, is kind of boring.
I was fascinated in your decision to create these three almost chapel-like rooms, and we'll come back to this whole issue of chapels in a moment. And you had the opportunity to populate them with virtually any work of art we had in the museum. And in fact, you and Pierre decided to more or less replicate the kind of inherent taxonomy of the museum, with the architecture and design objects in one space, photography essentially in a second space, and painting and sculpture in a third space.
Yeah, that's that is like a small model, like shrinking MoMA in its departments. That you can see not as a critique, but it's just what it is. And why should we not to do it this way, because whether you have hoovers or mirrors or plates, or I'm actually not even so interested in these things. It's just what we found that what went well together in the form and proportion, rather than this being exactly. It has a few pieces that we badly wanted that we didn't get because they were too big or were in another show, just like the Richter, you know, the terrorist.
Badr Meinhof series.
But we had a poster from the zoo in Basel, which I absolutely wanted, which I found quite funny. Then it has one of our pieces, you can hardly see it, which I think is also funny. And then it has some absolute great art masterpieces. And then it has a few things that I quite like in their combination. But as I said before, I don't see the main... our main contribution in that we think that Gober and Naumann and Barney are together in this or that particular way. That is beyond our, let's say, our expertise.
So was there, as you were going through the collection and selecting objects, were they purely the objects you liked most? Were there some overriding aesthetic issues that you were interested in? How did you ultimately come down to this group of objects?
We had a big list of things that we wanted, and then we saw that the space was not so big. So we couldn't have some... We wanted to have some of the real heroic pieces. Of course, we wanted to have a big Pollock, and I wanted a big Rothko. So I wanted this American dimension, but that already we couldn't do.
This is the inherent problem of being a curator.
But all those artists who we not only love and respect a lot are there, but maybe not with their most important pieces. But as I said, whatever is in these collections is really amazing. So the job was relatively easy. It was really, I mean... I don't mean to understand me, but it was really just like on a page, and you have to make sure that everything fits because you have so little space. Even if we congested it, and then we limited the space even more because of these slots, and you can enter, you know, with your head, so you can grasp at least the lower part of a picture. So it was really a kind of a puzzle, kind of a way we had to work.
Early on, when we were talking about the project before you actually got into the designing of it, some of the images you showed were of churches and chapels. Do you want to talk a little bit about how that relates to this installation?
Yeah, absolutely. By the way, the chapel reference is interesting in what I said before, that I'm absolutely convinced that the future of architecture, or one of the possible futures, is that the split of disciplines, art and fashion and architecture, film and all these things, is an artificial one. And we live in a time where I think this kind of separation, segregation, has been shrinking. I think that we have more contact with fashion designers or artists and filmmakers than, let's say, a generation of architects before us. And so it's perhaps, when I said that, I was so fascinated by the Chinese temple that I saw, or also the chapels that fascinated me always, is that it has these other elements that are mandatory so that it works. And you do not split things, but we are used, all of us, to experience things in this kind of segregated way. And of course, I'm inspired, or I'm culturally, or whatever, from where I come from in Switzerland, that those chapels that fascinated me in the Grisons in Graubünden, where you have painted ceilings, those Romanesque chapels. Where, of course, the way the painting and the wall and the architectural space is one thing, and that you took mirrors to see that that kind of motif on the ceiling. In earlier days, they didn't have mirrors, but we have mirrors now. So I like the mirror, even if it's not a very religious idea, but I like the mirror because nobody knows exactly what you see in the mirror. So you have that kind of secret way to look at things, which I liked very much, in combination with this idea of the religious and being surrounded by images. We were thinking of introducing sound and smell, but we just didn't go as deep into that matter. But in a possible next installation, I would love to introduce smell and sound into the space.
That would create a different kind of pressure. That would not be the pressure on the visitor. That would be the pressure on the museum.
Yeah. But talking about smell, you may not be aware as much as I am, because being in America, you get used to these smells everywhere that are in the carpets and everywhere. When you arrive in an airport, you can smell the city.
Sure.
And it's the coffee and all these sometimes really terrible smells that you can hardly get rid of. And in this museum, you don't have that smell anymore. But there used to be more smell in the earlier building. because of the carpets, probably.
Because there were so many carpets in the other building.
Yeah, because the carpets, of course, are more... more difficult to clean and to get rid of all these things. And so smells are there. The question is only what kind of smell. And to make it an active part, even if I hate these little trees that you find sometimes in taxis, but to actively incorporate that is not uninteresting. It happens in supermarkets, where the food is being, food smell is enhanced, which I find disgusting, of course, but at least I think it's interesting to think of that, because this is a kind of an idea of holistic culture, but maybe not in the same way as it could be.
Of course, there's some artists like Ernesto Neto who consciously work with scent, who, using spices and other ingredients, want you to take away a deeply olfactory quality from what they do. But I'm struck by this sense of smell because when you travel, you tend to be far more acutely aware of these differences. I remember landing in New Delhi for the first time and just almost short-circuiting because it's not just the amount of smell, it's the different smells. And in fact, on the issue of perception, I think scent is absolutely essential.
Yeah. And I think it's very architectural, actually. And we did a scent, a perfume, because we wanted to demonstrate in which way smell is always related to space, and on traveling is mostly much more related to architecture and cities than it is to fashion designer or sportsman, even if those are mostly the people who design smells.
You mentioned earlier on when you were talking about this idea of anchor rooms as something that grows out of this project, other museums that you're working on. And although I haven't seen detailed plans, the parish is actually a series of pavilions that perhaps can be understood as different rooms or anchors. Do you want to talk a little bit about that project?
I don't know, Trudy, you're here. I don't know how much I can say. Because, of course, there, anchors can be... An anchor could be very, as the word says, very specific, because it holds on somewhere. And it, within the building, but also maybe beyond the building, within, relating to the history and the tradition or the geography or topography or whatever, is making that space or that building different. And I believe very strongly in the difference, the idea of the difference and the specific, as opposed to the idea of the generic. I think that's what everybody is interested in. But we cannot create artificially whatever makes anything specific. So an anchor room could be an idea for that. And in the case of the parish, we want to strongly relate anchors to artists who have a very important tradition in that place and for that museum, and there are quite a few of those. And some of them would be devoted to those artists, to the work of those artists, but we would also like to incorporate their studios. So somehow we reproduce artist studios not in a Disney Worldian way, with smell or so, but light, proportion, scale, as if it was brought there into the museum. So we create analogy and difference and diversity within a group of pavilions which otherwise are standard spaces, and all of a sudden you enter one which is different and which has this kind of direct relation to some people who have been important. And in the model, this brings amazing results, and I think it would be interesting to see where this will lead us.
You've worked on a couple of private museums, or effectively private foundations, as well as a number of major public institutions. Is there a difference between the private space that you create for looking at art and the more public spaces?
You mentioned the museum, the first one actually we've done for Jeannie Gutz, and that was special in many ways. It was so special because it was for her, and it was our first museum, or small museum. And we have learned a lot doing this, which we could later apply or use in doing a bigger building. I don't think that there's such a difference between public and private. You mentioned the Schaulager. The Schaulager has everything of the private and also of the public. The Schaulager doesn't want to be overly public. In the contrast to other museums, like the Tate, for instance, which needs to be extremely public and needs to work extremely well as a public institution. Because perhaps even more than MoMA, it attracts crowds, which is just millions and millions of people. So the museum or the building, the whole concept has to be fit for that. So I think that one of the important things that we have been learning over the last years is that, of course, we are architects, and at the end of the day we are being judged by how good this architecture is. But to do architecture which is working well, you need to really learn over the time to do other things, how to program a place. For instance, this idea of the concept of anchor rooms is so important, and we couldn't do some of the museums that we are doing if we were not able to go almost part of the time of the job on the side of the curators. Not that, don't misunderstand me, that we believe that we can do this job better than the curators, but that we look at the institution from a curatorial side. From that point of view, also this piece here at MoMA is really absolutely crucial for our evolution. It was really a very important learning piece, and very important for us to, I think, do museums more successfully. That's one thing. That's the curatorial thing that applies, of course, for the public museum. And to make it public, how is a museum in relation to the city? What's the city you do the building for? And too many museums are more or less abstract, formal, stylistic exercises from architects, and not enough done in order to generate public life, to deal with public life. And just what I said about the specific, I also strongly believe in the idea of the public, which was also said to be dead a few years ago, and not too long ago. But I think that cities can only survive if we reanimate the idea of the public and how to live in public and how to create tolerance in public. And I think museums can play an important role in this.
Do you want to elaborate on that? Is that what aspect of the museum, and specifically, what is the role of architecture in engaging the public in that kind of space?
The way it is opening itself without disturbing art, without being just an entertainment space, it is very important that in the case, let's say, of the Tate or MoMA, to have a flow through the building, that people use the museum, even if they don't visit art, to make it really an attractive space to meet, to be an iconic place in the city. And, of course, to have a good restaurant, a good bar, but also educational facilities to think what could education actually be. I really believe that, I mean, this is something which is beyond architecture, but I think that talking about art, but also about architecture, in earlier phase of our lives, is very important. And there, too, museums can make an even bigger contribution than they do now. When we talk about purely architectural things, I talk about the Tate because this is what we have done. For instance, the success of the Tate has to do, let's say, I mean, the public success, not the institutional success, is the Turbine Hall. To leave that huge space empty could either have been a totally stupid idea or a really successful idea. And we were glad it turned out to be a successful idea because this is really a space that didn't exist before. So it was an urbanistic, more than an architectural idea to say, this is what we do, and this is why the museum can become very popular, and that space plays a special role, independent from how you run the museum. But on top of this, now the museum has launched this series of artists' installation in that space, which I think makes a very good marriage. Certainly this is one of the things that I think, without, I don't want to sound arrogant, but I think this is could be seen as a good example where all these things come together and make it more than just an architectural thing. It is a public idea. It's an idea of public and urban life. And you cannot always invent that, or you don't always have the inspiration or whatever. The things are not, the ingredients are not always on the table. But ideally, this is what a large public museum should offer to a city.
Wearing your curator's hat still for a moment, what are the museums that you find most interesting? What are the installations that... Are there specific installations as you've gone around the world that resonate for you, that become part of your mental landscape?
I mean, it's either individual pieces that always strike me when I see them, and then there is something that you could see as an anchor, you know? When I see the Rothko room in the Tate, or when I see individual great pieces, I mean, you only have anchors. MoMA is perhaps the only museum which is filled with pieces which are... I mean, when I walk through your contemporary show, this is amazing. Of course, I love the Schaulag. I say this because Maya is here, not only because I think this is really amazing, how these spaces work. And I love to go back to see that. I think this is something that is very important for museums, that it contains these spaces where you must go back if you love this kind of art. I mean, strangely, I like 15th, 16th century painting very, very much. And I love to go back to museums in New York, in London, in Basel, in a few other cities, Madrid, of course, to see this or that particular painting. Strangely, more old museums have that kind of permanence in how they present things. Fewer modern or contemporary art museums have that insisting of the permanence of how they show a piece. And clearly this is something I like. This is this idea of the chapel, perhaps.
Should we open this up to the floor? May I ask, if you have a question, speak as loudly as you can. We'll probably hear you, but it's so that all of your friends in the audience can also hear you in the far back.
You mentioned the words temporary and permanence quite a bit in reference to perception restraint. You talk about the idea that it can only work as a temporary condition. Is there a strategy or are there ideas that you can take from perception restraint that can influence the way a museum presents its permanent collection?
It's more the idea of the anchor space. It's not that I think that MoMA or any other museum would now want to congest all their works and to replicate this. I think this only works as temporary insulation. But as I try to explain, you can create other types of anchor spaces. This is what I would love to see, also in MoMA, for instance, that there would be a permanent place for the Richter pieces that we just saw and a few other places, which would almost have a special space. And I can imagine that, I mean, this is also happening, that together with an artist, you develop a space which is both architecturally and curatorially and artistically something that cannot be replicated and that has in itself a certain permanence. But you cannot do this endlessly because otherwise the museums would be too large. So you can reverse it and you could say that a museum, especially one which doesn't have so much, it doesn't have almost nothing, you can create 3-4 really strong anchors and the rest can be more generic or more lofty or more temporary in the way it's installed. This is more of an overall concept than one particular way that I think, personally, one could show art, because I think that has to be left open to the curators.
Yes, please.
I'm wondering if you could talk specifically about the Schauwager and what distinguishes it from the other museum projects you've done.
What is different?
Yes.
I mean, the biggest difference is the conceptual idea, which is comes from the client. They approached us with this idea which was striking and shocking at the same time to do something which was more of a storage, actually, than a museum. I think they wouldn't like to call the Schauwager a museum. And this combination of show storage and museum spaces and a few other functions makes it totally different from any other institution in the world.
Yes, in the middle, please.
I liked your installation very much, but I noticed there was a certain element of physical discomfort to it. Your body and neck had been moving in very strange ways to look at things or to perceive things. And physical discomfort is something that architects are usually trying to avoid or played with, but never explicitly sought out. But just as certain foods gain their power by being overly spicy or overly potent or overly bitter, and just as much of the avant-garde art was created by people in corsets and ties, I was wondering what you had to say about the connection between sensuality and discomfort, and whether the physical discomfort, especially in a world that's saturated visually and sonically, whether discomfort specifically sought out could be a new tool of the architect, whether the specific discomfort of a space could be a positive attribute.
I don't think it could be positive if it's permanent and if it's everywhere, because I think one of the ideas of architecture is that it has to stand to be there and you stand with your feet. And many architects have tried, constructivists or deconstructivists and others, to shock the world. And I don't think that you can do this with architecture permanently. But you can have ingredients of that in an installation or in one particular part of a building. Or, you know, I mean, of course I like to play with these kind of ways of how you perceive things. And I don't believe in stability as the only value that you should find in architecture. But I think that's what makes this thing different from another project, that we can be more experimental, even if at some times we are quite experimental with our buildings. But this kind of moment of discomfort in a larger scale, I think we would have quite a big problem with most of the clients.
Yes?
In Texas, you were selected to design a museum for the University of Texas, which was ultimately never built. And I'm just wondering if that experience changed the way you work for a museum client.
Not necessarily. We decided not to do that project because we were put under too much pressure from the political side, from the Republican jury, which wanted to force us into a kind of a stylistic exercise of I don't know exactly which period it was, but. That was an exception, and it was quite sad, actually, because it would have been an interesting city to do some work. Sorry.
Yes?
I recently finished a stadium project, and I guess have one under construction now.
Which project, sorry?
With the stadium project.
Oh, okay, yeah.
How do they engage this notion of the public? And obviously, they're a very public institution. Probably more so than an art museum today, engage with the public. So I was just wondering, in what ways have you learned from those projects in terms of museums or vice versa?
We cannot speak generally about stadiums. We have done two soccer stadiums, one in Basel, one in Munich, and the public or the crowd for a soccer stadium has changed quite dramatically since we don't live in an industrial society anymore where you have the classical client, which was the worker, and stadiums were uncovered, which were rather primitive infrastructures. Now it's like opera houses for a middle class, which has much more offering in terms of food and lounges and everything. So it's a totally different thing and became quite interesting. Before we did Basel and Munich, hardly any architect has worked in a stadium. It was more given away to developers or to big constructors. But in fact, it's quite an interesting topic. And to make it publicly more interesting is something that we could study in Basel in a way that really it is, has become like a, not a church, but really like an opera house for a large part of the population. And in Munich is the same, but in a larger dimension. And now in Beijing, we do an athletic stadium, the Olympic Stadium, which is totally different because it's less of a fighting arena. Soccer is much more about the fighting spirit between two teams. An athletic stadium is more under the sky, relatively peaceful. You have all these athletes. It's a totally different mentality. But there, the problem will be how does a stadium, an Olympic stadium, survive after the Olympics? And we designed it in a way that around the pitch, the whole structure is really like a small city and is a covered public space that we hope, and we did what we could, to make it survive after the games and to make it one of the major public covered spaces in Beijing. We love to compare it a bit like to the Eiffel Tower. The Eiffel Tower was conceived to be a structure just for an event and turned out to be a space that didn't exist as such in the city before. And when you see old photographs of the Eiffel Tower, of all these people with the umbrella walking under the Eiffel Tower, this has the architecture and the public space and the experience of that has become a new, almost iconic place in the city. And all we try to do is to go that way, to do the stadium in a way that it is outside the Olympic, because the Olympic Games is not so interesting, actually. To make it something really, really important and permanent for after the games, because the games are over after 3 weeks, and such a huge effort for only 3 weeks would be ridiculous. So it has to contain another idea, which must be stronger than the games.
Yes, in the far back.
So between the last couple of questions, we've talked about stadiums, public life, generating positive urban impact. And those three things are coming to a head in a couple of areas where they have in the last year in this city. I wonder your thoughts about those things, and also creating larger impacts between neighborhoods and taking in some sort of social planning into account in architecture.
That's a more tough question, but it's we are faced with this question in Basel. Even if this is a small city compared to New York, this is extremely important. And we are more and more faced with the question, not so much about how to integrate those different social groups, but between the gap between the global and the local. And especially when you have big global companies or big global competitors doing projects in a city, how can these live next to the local needs, and both in terms of scale, in terms of space, in terms of people using these infrastructures. And we don't have one kind of solution to do this. To make a project publicly interesting is one way, one thing. We tried to do this in Barcelona with the Forum building, where we lifted the whole program part and created new program which was not given by the client, in order to almost implement other forms of life, normal people, local people. And architecture, also big scale, global architecture, could either survive when you segregate it, that's the less interesting thing, or when you try to mix it or implement local programs. And we have now started with a small group in Basel with urban social geographers to discuss possible programs, possible spaces to do this.
You're also working on some fairly large-scale urban plans in China as well as in Europe.
We are doing the whole master plan for Spanish city of Burgos, which is a mid-sized city. And the interesting thing is that, strangely, they give this whole job to an architect. And architects were rather removed from urban planning since the 60s or 70s. And now we have this big whole city planning on our drawing boards. We have a big urban master plan project in St. Petersburg. We have a few others, one also in China. And in all these cases, this idea of the segregation versus the public is a key element. And when we talk about Russia or China or the Arab world, the notion of public or openness is, of course, should be seen from a different angle. What we believe should be public is not necessarily the opinion of everybody.
Yes, please.
Is the garden of the Museum of Modern Art an example of your idea of an anchor space?
That's a very good point. I would say yes. I would say yes. Very much so.
Could you speak more about gardens in relation to architecture?
I wish I knew more about gardens. But we try to learn. I think it's especially when we are working in, can do this job in Miami, one thing that strikes me when I go to the city is the potential of landscape and plants, vegetation in this place. And this is certainly one of those things that has not been used in a way that it should be or it could be to create something different from what you would normally find. And gardens, I do some exercises with my own little garden at home, I have started to plant, to implement plants which don't necessarily grow there. But they have survived one strong winter, for instance, cypresses, which I always hated because they remind of cemeteries. But they have an amazing olfactory potential, and because I'm such a freak with a smell, I planted these trees, also an olive tree and figs, all of them grow in Basel, strangely. And they have changed the smell of the garden. And when I put my nose in the cypresses, even if it rains, of course more so when there is a lot of sun, you have really a kind of mental trip. And I think that this, to use, I mean, plants or architecture, to do this kind of, to extend the dimension of what normally makes, forms part of what you normally encounter is certainly interesting. And I'm sure the gardens have that potential, but only we haven't been able so far to exploit it as much as we could. But we are increasingly interested in that.
Yes, please.
Yes, I'm just kind of related to the idea of scent and perception of art going back into the gallery. In a way, museums are themselves anchor spaces within our urban context, to a certain degree, and part of our responsibility as architects to consider making public or looking to where public can be made within the museum space. And you take the Turbine Hall at the Tate Gallery, how many, many people can fit in that space, and then how many, many people then go to galleries. And when you have too many people under the cypress tree, you can't smell it anymore. And how does the differing, the increasing populations within museums, the unpredictability of populations within museums, the Louvre is designed for 4 million, and now close to 8, does that counter our mission to continue to make museums anchor spaces within the urban environment? Are we compromising the experience of art? Where are we headed with these?
I like your comparison to the overall city, that museums really have this moment of concentration, of difference in some way. So that clearly I could sign. But the other part, the second part of the question, in when it comes to how big can a museum be and what happens in the future, I think that's a very tricky question, and there is no clear answer. I think that somehow the Tate was faced with this question when they made the decision to grow even more. And I think both for the Tate but also for MoMA, to imagine a third or fourth, you know, phase, I don't say it's not possible, but sooner or later you have to wonder how do you experience that as one thing, and shouldn't you split it once you reach a certain size? I cannot really now. I think we are really on an interesting way with the second part of Tate, because it was really difficult to imagine how this could work as a whole organism, but to make the new building really in itself a very strong piece, so to make both, being making it one thing and, you know, making it different. When we worked on the charrette here, certainly one of the ideas was, is the whole block sooner or later MoMA, like a small city? So the anchor would be a congested city in the city, which in fact somehow it is already now. But what would these other parts be? Would there be small Schaulagers or big galleries which are only like for one thing or another? I think that in this respect, when you grow endlessly museums, you are faced with kind of limit in how do you fill them. I mean, some museums have huge attendance, huge crowds, but maybe only in London and New York, maybe in Paris. All other cities, they don't attract so many visitors. So if you grow the museums more and more and more, it's I don't think this is going to be a solution, which is really interesting. But I cannot give an answer for, you know, for the whole future, because it also has to do with how art develops and many other things.
The question actually reminded me of one of my favorite anecdotes from the whole charrette process that was instigated by Jacques and Pierre. When we went through this exercise, we really asked each of the architects who participated to imagine the museum in fundamentally different ways, not to feel constrained by any of the pre-existing conditions. And at one iteration that Jacques explored, I don't even know if you remember it, was moving the garden to the roof. And as this, you can imagine, an august group of trustees, including David Rockefeller, who was born in a house adjacent to the garden, and the garden's named in his mother's honor. And I don't know if you remember this, but there was a kind of quiet gasp as these trustees thought, oh my goodness, the one anchor space. Because I think everyone, certainly since the 50s when Philip designed the garden, has recognized that it is a core space to the museum. Shocked by this, and there was it felt like it was a 2-minute silence. It probably was 3 seconds. And then David Rockefeller said, now, Mr. Herzog, would this be the same size as the garden? And he said, yes. And would it have the same trees and water courses in it? And he said, yes. And then he said, would it also have sculpture in it? And Jacques said, yes. And I was thinking, where is this going? At which point he then said, so it would be just like Mother's Garden, only at a different elevation. And I've always loved that anecdote because, one, of course, it shows the way in which a really remarkable human being, David Rockefeller, thinks. But also, I think it got to the heart of what Jacques and Pierre were exploring at that time, which wasn't to remove the garden, but to alter that urban experience, to recognize that if you change the location, the altitude of the garden, you also change the way in which the city is experienced. And I was struck by that, stuck in my mind, because if you're in Rockefeller Center on one of the higher floors and you look down, there are in fact these very beautiful roof gardens that project out on the two buildings that abut Fifth Avenue. And we tend to think of gardens as always being on the ground, and they can often be very interesting when they're not. That was a parenthetical interlude. Was there a question, Lee?
But maybe I could just quickly say, of course, this was certainly a stupid idea, but on the other hand, it is an artificial layer. We have to be very clear, and whether it's there or somewhere else is, in principle, not different. It is, of course, different when you experience it. That's why I say it could be eventually stupid. But what is really actually fascinating in Manhattan is that this whole city is built on solid rock. And we have done that one project in Manhattan. It's not actually known to anybody because we still haven't finished it. It's the Prada headquarters, their offices, and because they will sooner or later do an art space there. And you will enter that building. It's a piano factory on the north of Chelsea. We dug out the whole a garden they've had. It was just, covered with asphalt and industrial place, and dug it out. And the rocky soil was about half a meter below that. And we dug it out, and it looks spectacular. It looks like a landscape of glaciers halfway between Switzerland and the North Pole. It is really unbelievable. And it is there, and we will do that kind of rock garden. And that's, of course, something you cannot lift up, you know. That's different. And ultimately, behind this idea of the garden is also this idea, where are we? Where do we stand? And where does the museum start, actually? And it was also related to this particular space, Titus, which was one of those caves. This was also, is also, in fact, an anchor, even if the design is not, let's say, something which is very memorable.
You have to see. I have to now do my promotion for the Walker Arts Center. You have to see what Jacques did for a theater at the Walker Arts Center for a memorable theater.
Maybe this is too memorable, but this is.
Lee, you were patiently waiting to ask a question.
Speaking of MoMA, you mentioned before that you were actually happy not to have been the architect. What did you mean by that? And how do you regard, in more detail, how do you regard what actually has resulted in this?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the first.
You mentioned before that you were actually happy that you weren't the architect for MoMA.
Oh.
What did you mean by that, and how do you regard what actually is here?
No, I maybe you shouldn't overinterpret this.
You have to also know she's a reporter, so.
Oh, okay. No, I think that is a very tough job, for so much money to do an expansion project when the museum continues its function large part of the construction time, and that especially in our case we were working on the Tate and doing the Tate and MoMA at the same time, and we were 10 years younger than now, so we were still relatively young for an architect, was probably a huge challenge. Not so much in the terms of design or so, but in a political dimension, was certainly something where the pleasure would be less than, let's say, the pressure from different sides. But of course, when you are in the process of designing or the dialogue, which I must say was always really, really interesting, then you want it. I mean, when you go for something in a competition, you only see that. But afterwards, sometimes you can see in many different things in your life, maybe that was better not to do this. And in this case, we believe that was quite good, even if I'm sure, Glenn, you remember when you announced us not to be the winners, we were devastated,
And your reaction to what has, in fact, been built here? Could you discuss the building and
how I find it?
Yeah.
I think it perfectly is what MoMA wanted. And I think it's really the kind of idea of the modern translated in our time, which is what got built. And I think it couldn't be more perfect for this. We would have done it differently, it's clear, but what should I say?
Yes, Barbara.
My question is back to you as curator. I would, having seen the Tate installation of your building elements, and now that you have so many new projects, would you do another exhibition like that?
Would I do another exhibition like the one at the Tate?
The elements of your building.
Of our, you mean of our monographic show?
Right.
Would I do what?
Would you, since you have so many new projects, would you do it again in some fashion?
Would we again lay it out on tables?
Right. Sort of? Right.
We have done it. This show started at the Schaulager and went to Tate and two other places. And once you have done four venues, you don't want to repeat this necessarily because it's very costly and you have seen it. So when we, in the far future, we will do another monographic show, it will be a totally different one. We've done one 10 years ago at the Centre Pompidou with Rémy Zauk, which was also very different. And then the Schaulager show, which went to the Tate, which was a kind of a market. And now I don't know what we would do. I also am not interested in knowing because it's too close, and Sunday we wouldn't want to repeat that.
We'll take one more question. Yes, please.
My question just has to do more with you as an artist. You sort of disregarded that you're not an artist, but I was thinking more along the lines of the pressure that you feel going into a new project, and if you feel as a top architect, if you feel more pressure now to perform as opposed to sort of early on, and how that affects you, and if there is a pressure at all.
No, I wouldn't say this is a pressure. The only pressure is actually traveling. I hate to travel, and I have to travel so much. But to do projects, we have never wanted to have a style or to have something that people would see us only this, doing this or that. That would be a pressure if I had to fulfill a role, which would always be the same. But we quite enjoy what we do, actually. I think we are very spoiled.
Let me draw this to a close and thank Laura Bayless and David Little for having organized this, Jacques for having shared a large part of the evening with us. For those of you who have not seen his stadium, especially in Munich, I urge you to do so. It is truly astounding and one of those, I think, transformative buildings that really alters the way we think about space and about a kind of typology. And to all of you for having joined us, thank you so much. We'll see you next time. And Jacques, thank you.